Tonight on The Download, Chicago Sun-Times chairman Bruce Sagan, Victory Gardens actress Lizanne Mitchell, and live music in Studio 435 from The Congregation. Now here's your host, a man who now has way too many socks after Father's Day, Justin Kaufman.
She's not lying.
Oh my God, I have like 14 pairs of new socks. Orange, yellow, pastel, blue, little tan. I got some hot socks. I'm not gonna lie to you, I got some hot socks for Father's Day. People were listening to me. Remember I said that a couple weeks back. If your Father's Day, get some socks. Now I feel like I have too many socks. Oh, my life. Welcome to The Download here on WGN Radio 720. I'm Justin Kaufman with you till 11 o'clock tonight. Got a wonderful show lined up for you. We got a wonderful week lined up. Man, the hits keep coming. Thanks to everybody who came out to the Taste of Des Plaines on Friday. Such a good time. Pete, how did the Rasta banana go over with the wifey?
Loved it. Loved it.
I thought the pause was to be like, not so good. She was wondering where the money went. If you did not listen, Pete was at the carnival games at the Taste of Des Plaines, and he attempted to win a Rasta banana for his wife's birthday, and he spent a good $100 and missed about, I would say, 78 shots.
Yeah.
Percentage. Basketball. The percentage, yeah. Not so good.
Not so good.
You were like a low-rent Shaquille O'Neal.
You know, and the worst thing about it, too, is that I come back and I find two leftover Taste of Des Plaines tickets in my pocket.
You could have gone two more times.
Yeah, I could have.
That would have been good for like a brisk iced tea, like a can of brisk iced tea. That's all you get for that. But it was a great festival. Yeah. Thanks for having us out there. Tonight, big show coming up. We're going to argue about politics. Big day for Donald Trump. Fired his chief of staff. What's that mean for the campaign? Many insiders and Republican establishment are asking him to reboot his campaign. Will it make a difference? We will argue that on Touche coming up here after the 7:30 news. Tonight, my guest at the big table, none other than chairman of the Chicago Sun-Times, Bruce Sagan. We're going to talk with Mr. Sagan about whether or not Chicago will continue to be a two-newspaper town. What are the plans for the future? And is the fight between the Chicago Tribune and the Chicago Sun-Times like it has been in the past? Or is it really about newspapers in general versus social media? That's what we'll talk about as Bruce Sagan is my guest at the big table tonight. So coming up in the 9 o'clock hour, we're going to talk about the new show that's opening up at the Victory Gardens. It's called The House That Will Not Stand By. No, I'm sorry, The House That Will Not Stand By resident playwright Marcus Gardley. Directed by Che Yu, who we had on this program. Tonight, starring Lizanne Mitchell, the star of the show, will be in studio. She's great. She's been all over. She's been on stage and screen, everything from Broadway to soap operas. She was on Guiding Light. She starred in The Preacher's Wife. She was on television shows like The Good Wife and Law and Order. It's a great play that deals with women and race as well as what it means to be free, especially when the law says one thing but society says another. We will talk with Lizanne and also Isaac Gomez coming up here in the 9 o'clock hour. Also, a new dark comedy feature film in the works from the husband-wife team of Sean Miller and Naz Khan. It's called The Replacements, and it takes place in the not-too-distant future. It's sort of like a science fiction comedy, and it focuses on the story of the first clone president. That's not that far off, let's be honest. That's coming up as well. And it's Monday night, so it's time to open up Studio 435. Tonight's live performance comes from the Chicago soul outfit, The Congregation. Love this band. They're playing Shake the Lake in Madison and Second City on Sunday. I can't wait to shake it in studio. They come through in the 10 o'clock hour. News, weather, and traffic with Roger Badish and Esmeralda Leon. Production provided by Pete Zimmerman. I'm Justin Kaufman. This here is The Download, a show about Chicago starring those who know it well. All right, we'll take a break. Come back. Get the carry out. Stay with us. All right, let's get this thing started, shall we? With you till 11 o'clock tonight. It's a download here on WGN Radio. It's time for the carry out. This, of course, is our nightly segment where I read the newspaper. So you at home, you don't have to. Here are
are today's top stories. Donald Trump fired his chief of staff today. Hey, you know, it was either Corey Lewandowski or John Sally. And Sally did so well with the lemonade stand challenge. Ugh. No word on whether or not Bill Rancic or Amorosa will take over. I hope it's Bill. You know, the local kid. Done good. Word out of the Clinton camp is if she goes the unexpected route and picks Senator Elizabeth Warren as her running mate, she can kiss Wall Street support goodbye. So let me get this straight. If she picks the one senator that would regulate Wall Street, Clinton will lose Wall Street support, which means contributions for the campaign, and she's seriously considering it. Do you realize why our country is so Chicago's deadly weekend claimed 13 lives and 41 shootings, although there's so many numbers floating around, it's hard to say if that's the bottom line. This is way up from last year at this time and getting close to double from 2 years ago. So essentially, that line graph, it's going the wrong way. Not a strong start to the summer since, well, summer starts today. So what can be done? More police on the streets? Nope, that costs money. Violence prevention programs? Nope, that was cut by the state. National Guard? They're busy in Iraq. So while this is happening here, I hate to be the downer, but the whole world is going haywire. Syrian and other war refugees topped 65 million this week. The UK may bolt from the EU, and there are supposedly hundreds of babies in Puerto Rico that will be born affected by the Zika virus. So yeah, I guess the whole world is having a case of the Mondays. I'm crabby today. It's just so much bad news. Governor Rauner's campaigning. I'm sorry, governing. This week in Chicago, he told the Trib editorial board that he is going to run for a second term. Yeah, why not? You've done such tremendous work. Can't wait for the TV ads. Governor Rauner accomplished so much in his first term. Governor Rauner is a man. 500 plus guards called in sick today at the Cook County Jail, forcing the jail into lockdown mode. I guess this is a trend since this also happened the Monday after the Super Bowl and the Monday after Mother's Day. Officials wonder if Father's Day, the NBA Finals, and the nice weather have something to do with it. Yeah. In weather, it's hot. In sports, the Cubs swept the Pirates out of Wrigley to go 8-1 against Pittsburgh this year. But how about rookie catcher Wilson Contreras' first at bat? Of course, home run. This whole team is unreal. Magic dust just spread around. They keep this up, they're going to break the MLB single-season record, which doesn't mean anything. Golden State. Also, the Cubs are rumored to be in talks with the Yankees for the services of closer Aroldis Chapman. Chapman throws 100, and he's arguably the best closer in baseball. But also, he served an early-season suspension for domestic violence. Do the Cubs not realize we're having a party here? Don't bring that baggage to our backyard barbecue. Come on. No. Pick someone who throws like 98. It's the same. It's not going to make a difference. The Cubs welcome the Cardinals tonight at Wrigley. Big series here, or not. The Cubs are 12 and a half games up. The most since 1929. On the other side of town. Yeah. You know what? The rumors for the White Sox include Ryan Braun coming to the South Side. Why not just get Jose Canseco out of retirement, too? And then he could join Braun and Cabrera in an all-PED outfield. Yeah, that's what we want, Sox fans. We want cheaters. LeBron James and the Cavaliers beat the Warriors in Oakland last night to win the NBA championship, and LeBron single-handedly changed the sports discussion from Golden State being as good as the 96 Bulls to is King James as good or better than Michael Jordan. I will say this, that it's kind of cool that Jordan and the Bulls are in all of the inane sports conversations happening all around the world, right? That's pretty cool. It's pretty amazing. And finally, a new study out just in time for summer says that pool goers don't get red eyes from chlorine. Nope. They get red eyes from the chemicals produced when chlorine is met with urine. That's right. We've all been swimming in pee. I guess it could be worse. No, it couldn't. That's the carryout for June 20th, 2016. Hey, free drinking water tonight. It's so hot out that we're just letting the hose run out back. Coming up, it's time for Touche. It's Monday night. We'll talk all things national politics with Chris Roebling and Dave Lundy. Coming up at 8 o'clock, the Sun-Times chairman, Bruce Sagan. It's the download here on 720 WGN. Stay with us.
All right, coming up after the news, it's Touche. Roger Badish, how are you, my man?
I'm doing fantastic. Sounds like you had a great weekend. I heard part of the show on Friday.
Yeah, it was a great Taste of Des Plaines, and then I went and saw the SpongeBob musical yesterday, the opening, which was really good show over at the Oriole.
And that's premiering here, isn't it?
It is. It's a tryout for Broadway. Got great reviews, both from Dean Richards and Chris Jones here in the Tribune. We're going to talk with Chris later in the week about it. You know, I'm not a critic. I like everything. There's rarely any experience that I go to that I'm like, oh, that's terrible. I didn't like the lighting. Like, you know, like for me, I'm like, oh, this is great.
You take in the whole experience. Yeah, that's cool. And that was the important thing that he liked.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So that was the important thing.
Excellent.
If I didn't like it, though, then it'd be less important that he liked it. If I didn't like it, then I'd be like, why did I waste this time?
Oh, you.
Even if he was like, I love it, I'd be like, no. Come on, man. I'll tell you why it was no good. Second act just fell apart.
The writing.
You
got to
teach him. No, I have big hopes for the boy.
Yeah.
You know, I'm like there were a couple times because he's a budding actor. There were a couple times that I was like, see the blocking on this? You see where SpongeBob's at? You see how he's talking to the audience like this? There we go. It's like a sports dad, but a
theater right,
dad.
Right. All right. See how he's holding the bat?
Exactly.
Just a little higher.
Yeah. See how he projects?
Yeah.
See how he goes up and then he comes down.
I just said that.
I know you just said that.
Okay, I'm not sure where you're going with this.
Well, I'm not sure where you're going with this.
That's what I just said.
That's what I'm saying to you.
All right.
Touche.
It's time for Touche, our weekly battle for national politics here on the download. Chris Roebling and Dave Lundy returns.
I am back.
He's back for spirited debates.
I have returned.
A lot to talk about tonight, guys. Why don't we start with Donald Trump? His campaign manager, deep sixed. Is that how you say it? Yeah, deep sixed.
Yeah.
Goodbye.
What does that mean? Is that usually a thing? I mean, I've seen, and it's hard to interpret a firing of a campaign manager because it seems to happen a lot. What does this mean?
You know, look, I view this kind of like if the Chuck E. Cheese franchise fired their manager. You know, things may change a little around the margins, but fundamentally, it's still going to be Chuck E. Cheese. So, I mean, Lewandowski was a sacrificial lamb. He had to go because something had to change, and you couldn't get rid of the guy who keeps saying the dumb stuff. And so they got rid of Lewandowski.
Dumb stuff was their stock and trade. I thought that they were going to double down on dumb stuff. I didn't know this was a campaign directive.
No, I think there were several layers to it. And who knows for sure if you're not there. Apparently, it was the kids who forced him out. They basically, many of them are MBAs, and they sort of sat back and said, look, the last 6 weeks have been a total disaster. We win the nomination in Indiana, and since then we've actually gone backwards, and we were challenging Hillary in the first few polls, and now we're down 10 points, essentially. And so something I agree with David, something had to change. Lewandowski also, you know, he goes down in American political history because this guy came with zero public sort of qualifications.
No pedigree.
And defeats 15 or 16 other Republicans when everyone is saying it cannot happen, and it kept happening. So Lewandowski ran a campaign basically on nothing, but that wasn't enough to get it into the general. And when things went south, he was expendable.
And I'm not sure he really ran much of anything. I mean, the fact is he really seemed to be more Trump's body guy, which is not usually the role of the campaign manager. So, I mean, I think that to the extent he ran anything, he clearly angered a lot of the other staff. And what was one of the most amazing things today was after Lewandowski got canned, and by the way, escorting a guy out with security who's been your bestest buddy, that seemed a little harsh to me. But they said, well, this is what we do. Okay. but then after they did that, the other guy, Michael Colton or whatever his name was,
Caputo.
Who was their communications guy.
Right.
He tweets, you know, ding dong, the witch is dead, accompanying a photo of the feet under the house in The Wizard of Oz.
About
Lewandowski.
About his buddy Lewandowski.
And so you're like, so my God, no wonder
now,
these guys have
I
been
heard,
doing this.
I heard a bunch of rumors on Twitter just about the idea of no non-disclosure. He walked out. He was fired. He's going to be a great source to find out what was happening inside the circus that was
I wouldn't
Trump.
Count on that. I wouldn't count on that. There's too much between these guys. And, you know, Trump made a big, notwithstanding the security escort, he made a big point of saying, you know, he's a friend of mine. I appreciate what he did. He did a phenomenal job. Everybody's got to recognize his achievement. You know, it's just time for a change. Okay, so Trump's going out of his way to keep the guy on the reservation. And I'm sure Trump's got a lot of ways of doing that. And I don't think no one benefits from kissing and telling in politics.
All right, so let's talk about what this means for Donald Trump. Obviously, Donald Trump has had a significant setback, as you said, since the nomination in Indiana.
Yeah.
Where does he go from here? What does he change? What's the strategy that he's changing with a new campaign?
Well, Paul Manafort, who I got to know 36 years ago in Connecticut in a very hotly contested race where he was ice cold under pressure, runs a very buttoned-down, organized, deliberate, scripted operation. Now, is he going to be able to do that with Donald Trump? Who knows? I don't think Donald Trump's going to change his spot, so to speak. He's Donald Trump, and that's who he is. But notionally, what you're looking for at this point is a candidate who's going to stay on message, who's going to go to states where he can win, who is going to somehow find a way to connect with the voters and build up a real a rationale, okay, for people supporting him. And what happens with Trump, he gets out to South Carolina on one day, and then he's in California the next day. And goodness only knows what he's going to say in California.
He seems undisciplined, yeah.
It's just all over the map.
Right.
Well, and what's amazing about this is that, you know, the beef on Hillary Clinton is that there's no message to her campaign. I've had this beef myself. And yet, when you look at the Trump campaign, you're like, yeah, okay, there's the Make America Great thing, but there's no message of the day. There's no message of the week. I mean, there have been so many opportunities that have been squandered by Trump, and it makes people like Chris go bananas, because what he's watching is, oh, there's a great opportunity going floating by like the flotsam and jetsam in the water.
Let me ask you, Chris, there was the big story on Friday about some delegates in the GOP and kind of a push to say we're going to try to change things at the convention, which was unheard of.
Which I was pushing last
week
pushing, on this program.
Exactly. So what do you make of that? I mean, is that sort of where Republicans are at right now, that they're not necessarily getting behind Donald Trump and he's the guy? I mean, there still may be some problems coming up here.
There was a moment a month and a half ago, 6 weeks ago, Indiana time, there was a moment when Trump was beginning to bring forces together and they were coalescing around whatever Trump was. And I don't disagree with David's characterization. And then he sort of went off the rails and we got into this fight over the judge and Mexican. And then he, you know, reacted, I think, bizarrely to Orlando and things like this. So now people are saying, look, I mentioned David Rivkin's article in the Wall Street Journal, but the fact is that if Trump died, God forbid, there wouldn't have to be a rule change at the RNC for those delegates to vote for Dave Lundy or Ted Cruz or whoever it is. So the idea that we have to go through some sort of big procedural change is, I think, flawed. And I think Trump's on the bubble. I think one of the reasons you see Lewandowski gone and Manafort in is to see if they can dial up performance between now and the convention.
So let's say that the convention goes forward and Donald Trump is the guy. Are we looking at something where the establishment Republicans who are more conservative, that are the more standard establishment, are they going to run a different candidate, independent?
I don't see that happening. I mean, Chris is right. Technically, all they have to do is have a vote of the Rules Committee. It's not clear to me exactly where every Rules Committee member stands. I mean, one of the challenges you've got is not just that Trump is undisciplined, not just that he's missing opportunities. He hasn't put together a campaign. I read the other day he has nationally 30 field staff. Those are the people who go out and organize their communities and organize their states. Think about this. There's 50 states. There's thousands of counties in this country, and they have
30 total people. Hillary's got to have high.
And he's responded to that saying, I don't need to do that because I got the media.
But that's not how it works.
Right.
The reality is
he hasn't had the media for the last 6 weeks.
Right. And he's not going to have them. What he doesn't understand, where Trump has failed to pivot, is not just in the personality requirements of being a candidate for the presidency of the United States, but he hasn't pivoted towards what it means to be in a general election versus a primary. I've made this point on the show. I made it during the primary. You had 13 million people vote for Donald, or whatever the number was, that more than anybody else. Bravo. And in the general election, you're going to have 140 million people minimum voting in this country, which means that at least 2/3 of the people have no idea about Donald Trump. They probably know nothing more than The Apprentice stuff.
This is getting super boring that I'm not getting. You guys are agreeing.
Sorry.
That's not what we signed up for.
Well, I have to say, I'm disappointed in Chris because I was counting on battering the heck out of him for the next 4.5 months. And now that he's left, I was so disappointed when I heard the show last week.
Well, you know,
Chris was walking away from Donald Trump. I'm like, no.
I can't go on these shows. I've been very privileged down, you know, nearly 30 years, although I haven't aged a day. But I've gone on a lot of shows. And honestly, I've been honest when I've been on these shows, and I've said, here's what I really think.
Oh,
and
come on. 3 weeks ago, you said he was going to win 40
tried.
States.
I'll tell you, at that time, when he was surging in the polls, you know, and don't sell this whole thing out. But look, I think that Obama is, we are closer to a recession than we have been at any time since the crash of 2008, 2009. We've got all kinds of red flags in the economy. We've got the Brexit vote coming up, which is probably going to still go. I think it's still going to go to exit the EU, which is going to cause a lot of disruptions and may send the economy into recession. And then you've got goofiness like Loretta Lynch, both censuring tapes and then in the same day saying, no, I didn't mean. She goes through this big, long explanation of how the American people cannot hear anything that has contradicted the official interpretation from her boss, Barack Obama.
That's not what
and
she
so
said.
What we're going to do is censure the tapes, and you're only going to be able to hear what we want you to hear. And then in the same day, she had to walk that back and admit she was wrong. Because she is, and this is the Attorney General of the United States. It is a freak show down there in
Washington.
I don't
want to bore you, Justin.
And this is what's going to get the Republican elected.
I don't want to bore you, but I actually agree with Chris again. Because, well, not about most of what he said, but about Loretta Lynch, because I watched Meet the Press live, and I heard when she said she's going to censor the transcript because she didn't want people to hear him say, I pledge my allegiance to ISIS, even though the transcript apparently said, I pledge my allegiance to blank. What do you think, it's Bugs Bunny? I mean, that was so stupid.
To the gold.
Now, there was a guy on road today that said that a lot of that censoring has to do with trying not to go with propaganda and say the name.
FOIA-able documents. These are documents that can be FOIA'd.
My issue is they were coming out anyway.
And this is the same Obama administration.
But it's not for the reason Chris said. It's not for the reason that Chris said.
Of course it is. Why the heck would they do it?
Because everybody knew what was in the transcript.
No, they're doing it because Obama is linked to this crazy narrative that we can talk about Islamic extremism and Islamic terrorism and not talk about Islam.
Excuse me, he said that. He talked about this in detail a week ago.
No, yes, he did. That was an attempt at self-justification for his.
He has the same position that George W. Bush had.
That is not true.
After 9/11.
Bush was never had any doubt about what he was fighting. And with Obama.
Yeah, he was fighting Dick Cheney to try to get a word in edgewise.
What Obama has been fighting is the reality of.
Feel better, Justin?
Radical Islamic extremism.
So you didn't buy with the president's big speech where he talked about it.
Another humiliation for the United States, another embarrassment. I mean, the guy, he's probably going to be proven wrong by the British people in the Brexit thing. He is absolutely. As far as I can tell, there isn't anybody. The reason that Loretta Lynch today reversed herself is because Obama's speech failed, which is not because he didn't give a good speech. His speech failed because his policy actions have been so nonsensical.
Dave Lundy, let me ask you this as we turn to the Democrat side. I mean, Did the hatred of the president from the
on
the
right? I don't hate the president.
Or not the hatred. Yeah. All right, let me say,
and he's a great
dad. The policies that are put forth by the White House at this point.
Yes.
Does that hurt a new campaign or somebody else that's running, where he can latch on, Roblin can latch on to things that are happening with President Obama and his administration and apply them to Hillary Clinton?
So that's a great question. So here's the thing. The Republican Party is afflicted with a massive epidemic of ODS, Obama Derangement Syndrome.
Like the Democrats
they are still running against Barack Obama. But here's the funny thing. Barack Obama's not. I have a secret to share with the listeners. This is a secret.
Okay, go ahead.
Obama's not running a third term.
But just 6 minutes ago in this very seat on that very microphone, you said there is no message to the Hillary campaign. And why? Because the message of the Hillary campaign is, I'm another term of Obama. That is her
with
statement.
Some severe and distinctions, all, including,
such as
including,
what?
You know, you earlier today when we were emailing about what are we going to talk about tonight on the show, you said, oh, the Wall Street Journal article on Iran proves that the Obama people don't know what they're talking about. Well, the Wall Street Journal article on Iran proves that the Obama people didn't know exactly what they were talking about. And Hillary Clinton
was far more. So that's why we gave $150 billion to the leading
Hillary Clinton
state sponsor
was far
of terrorism.
More hawkish. Than Barack Obama was when it comes to things like ISIS and Syria. And that's the reason, by the way, that when you saw what happened with Orlando, you didn't see the disparity you normally see between a Republican candidate and a Democratic candidate in the polls. You saw a tiny little difference in who is better to handle terrorism or who is better to handle what's happened in Orlando. And it's because Hillary Clinton is not the caricature you guys would like to paint her out to be.
No, Hillary Clinton is worse than the caricature. We cannot draw a caricature bad enough to encapsulate the reality of Hillary Clinton. And here is what I mean by that. Hillary Clinton, like every other lockstep liberal Democrat, such as yourself, decided that it wasn't a question of terrorism. It wasn't a question of allegiance to ISIS. It wasn't a question of this wolf pack of lone wolves that's all over the world and ready to self radicalizing themselves.
If it's a wolf pack, it's not lone wolves.
Well, this is the new expression. I didn't come up with this, but it's some, you know, New York council.
Stop believing what you read on the internet.
But here is what you, but what you're talking about here, according to Hillary, is what? A gun control failure. And so the Democrats go in and again humiliate themselves by coming up with two goofy ideas for gun control.
Yeah, like not keeping terrorists from buying.
Not one of which would have applied to this particular terrorist.
Actually, it would have.
No, neither
yes, it would
of
have.
The neither
yes,
of the Democratic.
It would have.
No, all four.
Dianne
of
Feinstein
the
talked
today.
About this yesterday explicitly. She said, "No, the way her bill is written, it would have had anybody under FBI investigation for terrorist connections still on that list. It would have prevented him from buying the AR-15 that he used to go into his gay nightclub. His
I don't. And
nightclub.
I would also
absolutely
argue, and we got to wrap because we're running up against the spots.
No
here,
way. No.
But I will say this, that, you know, as much as the Democrats may have humiliated themselves in losing that vote, there may be more humiliation on Republicans who voted against it in the way that what I'm seeing automatically is once again Congress not doing anything about what
because it's not because that's not related to the reality of what took place in Orlando.
So only on gun control, if you can't accomplish everything, you should do nothing.
No,
that's the rule of the Republican Party today.
NRA,
that's why you guys have boxed yourself into a corner and why Hillary is comfortable coming out in favor of gun control.
The NRA itself is supporting a measure for folks who are under active investigation to be prevented.
Oh, please.
If this guy...
27 caveats.
If this guy... So that they're... Actual constitutional rights are respected and there is due process before the deprivation.
Yes, because you need to give suspected terrorists due process. Thank you, Chris.
Sorry, now I'm the civil libertarian. Everybody deserves due process before deprivation of a civil right.
In here. We've all
I don't know what the heck is going on, Justin. What's in the water tonight?
Chris Roebling, Dave Lundy, I love it. Thank you guys for coming in. Chris is already walking out the door. He's grabbing his jacket. It's Touche.
Having a great time.
It's Touche here on the download every Monday. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
This is Chicago's very own 720 WGN Chicago and WGNRadio.com. Coming up, Bruce Sagan, the chairman of the board of Chicago Sun-Times. Talk about whether or not he sees Chicago being a two-newspaper town. About Michael Farrow and Tronc. Also talk about what the real competition of the 21st century is. It's not what it used to be where it was the Tribune versus Sun-Times. Now it's newspapers versus social media. We'll talk with Bruce Sagan about that and his career in newspapers. Roger Badish, not good news. Looks like the World Series dreams of the Chicago Cubs are they're teetering. They're losing right now.
Yeah, I'm ready to sell my tickets. Go to Craigslist. See what I can get for
it. Yeah, I knew it. I knew it.
It was too good to be true. Good.
Yeah. Coach Joe Maddon.
Yeah?
He makes bad decisions.
These young kids, they don't know what they're doing, even though Baez made a heck of a throw from third. You didn't see that
I
one.
Didn't see that, no.
Oh, it was just off the plate in foul territory. He planted his feet, nailed it, spun around, one bounce, bam, got him at first.
Saw a nice article today about how Javi Baez, who was really thrown about, his name was bantied about when it came to trades last year.
Yeah.
He's actually a chip that's been taken off the table. The Cubs like him a lot, and obviously, I mean, this year with Schwarber's injury and now Fowler on the DL, Hayward was out for a while. I mean, they've had injuries,
yeah.
But because of the flexibility of Javi Baez, particularly, they're like, we're not giving this kid up. So
yeah, it's
there. You go.
They'll come back. Thanks
for walking
foot.
Us off the.
It's going to be okay. Everyone, breathe.
Welcome back to The Download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, my guest tonight at the big table has a big job. But Bruce Sagan, he's used to that. Sagan is the chairman of the board at the Chicago Sun-Times. He was appointed to that job earlier this year after Michael Farrell left the paper to take over at the Chicago Tribune. Sagan is no stranger to newspapers. Not only was he part of the Rapports team that purchased the Sun-Times, but he started working in newspapers back in 1951. He still publishes the Hyde Park Herald. He's been doing it for 63 years. Bought that paper for $2,500 in 1953. He's also owned the Daily Southtown papers. He's invested in companies like the Financial Times and the New York Times. He actually helped the New York Times launch a national edition. He's also a current board member for several big Chicago companies like Steppenwolf and the Chicago Public Library Foundation. Bruce Sagan believes that Chicago is and should remain a two-newspaper town. And he's my guest tonight at the big table. Mr. Sagan, thanks for being here.
Pleasure to be here.
Let me start right there. I mean, do you still believe that Chicago should be a two-newspaper town?
I believe that Chicago should be a multiple journalism town.
Okay.
The word newspaper at the moment is complicated. And what you have is two important legacy newspapers that one would hope they would branch into whatever our new circumstance is 15 or 20 years from now.
Well, I mean, we've seen so much news on the other at the other newspaper for once, for a change. So it's probably nice for you. But we've seen a name change for the overall company. At the beginning of this sort of Michael Farrell leaving to the Chicago Tribune, there were talk that Farrell would want to come back and purchase the Sun-Times. Why don't we just get that question out of the way? Do you foresee a future in which Tronc would come and want to purchase the Chicago Sun-Times?
Do I see a future in which that's possible? Yes. Do I think it's going to happen? No. I mean, we're making progress. The problem is that our news is migrating to the web, to the internet. We're all learning how to do that. And the Sun-Times is learning how to do that. The Tribune's mm-hmm. learning how to do that. The New York Times, which is, in a sense, the leader in this circumstance, what are they leading in? People paying them on the web for their news. That's where we're going.
Mm-hmm.
That's where the Sun-Times is going to go sometime in the next 15 years. That's where the Tribune's going to go. You have to know that printing a newspaper is enormously economically inefficient. And so what you've got is you've got a change in the way people are getting their news, a huge change in the way they pay attention to information, and opportunities to do some wonderful things. I mean, you can do long-form journalism on the web. You know, in the newspaper, we always run out of space. On the web, you don't run out of space. And so there are lots of wonderful things happening. What's the problem? Problem is people think news is free on the web.
Mm-hmm. Well, how do you change that? Because you've been on record talking about that you think audiences would pay a subscription's price for the news. I mean, is that something that, that you think you can change an audience's behavior? You can.
Yes, I think they won't have a choice in a sense. You know, they'll have a choice of no news or they'll pay for it.
Right.
Which is, in fact, where it was up until radio, which we're on, right? And even after radio and television, people have paid for their news in the newspaper. The dollar you gave the, you know, the seller of the paper at the corner, you were buying the journalism. Nobody ever thinks about it that way. But the rest of the advertising in the newspaper that that really subsidized the mechanical problem of producing the newspaper.
Mm-hmm. Well, you've talked about almost seeing the Sun-Times as, you used the word portal, as the Sun-Times or the Tribune or the Reader, anything that becomes almost a voice for journalism as opposed to just a newspaper print product.
Right.
So talk about that. How do you see the portals here in Chicago coexisting?
Well, think about it in terms of brand preference. The reality is that the Sun-Times in its history has always been the scrappy little tabloid, more democratic than Colonel McCormick's Tribune. Mm-hmm. It has always taken a much more different kind of attitude towards the city. If you had the choice over what you read on the web, and there was only what the web is, what would you choose? You would choose the brands you trust. You would choose the brands that you think give you the kind of information you're after. And you'll pay for that because you do now. The fact of the matter is you don't have to pay any more than you're paying on the newsstand.
Right.
If you paid us what you pay on the newsstand for a web-delivered newspaper, we would have plenty of money for a newsroom.
You see some subscription models working. I think of Capital Facts in Springfield. I think of our friends at AltaTrack trying to do that kind
of
the idea of a subscription model. Do you see that being the economical model of the future? Or, you know, we've seen paywalls. We've seen all sorts of ways that companies have tried to monetize their content. Is there some stuff we're not even thinking about right now?
Well, what you're seeing is the development of what I call silos. Okay, AltaTrack is a silo. You got to want to know what the council committee schedule is today. Okay, there's no reason why, in fact, news isn't in silos, but we never think about it because we think about the newspaper as being broadly coveraged.
Mm-hmm.
If you happen to be interested in politics, you would go to a politics silo. You do, in fact. There's one in the Sun-Times, right?
Yeah,
you do. The section of the newspaper is essentially silos. If you can put together enough of those silos, you have a newsroom, just what we have now. Does that mean everybody will buy everything we produce? Probably not.
So you see it as almost the same model that Xfinity or Comcast has, where they can offer up cable channels and you can go a la carte on what kind of channel that you want. You want Bravo? No, I don't want that. I want ESPN. Yes, that kind of thing.
Exactly right. I mean, you know, the Sun-Times has always been good at sports, and it still is. And clearly, when the Hawks are about to win again, you know, more people will buy that day's coverage. I can see that the time when you'll go online and say, "Hey, I want today's paper from the Sun-Times," which I don't read all the time because I want to read the Bears coverage. And you'll get charged a buck.
Bruce Sagan is the chairman of the board of the Chicago Sun-Times. He's my guest tonight at the big table. Let's take a quick break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation about the future of portals. Is that that's better than newspapers, right, Bruce? All right, stay with us. Welcome back to The Download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. My guest at the big table tonight, Sun-Times Chairman Bruce Sagan. Bruce Sagan, of course, took over that job earlier this year after Michael Farrell left to go over to Chicago Tribune, or known as Tronc now. You're no stranger to newspapers, to the media world. I mean, let's talk about your career. I mean, you bought the Hyde Park Herald, which you still publish today,
yes,
in 1953 for how much?
$2,500.
$2,500.
Yes. Well, I was very lucky. I got into journalism in the age of the copy boy. when you could become a copy boy and learn journalism and eventually get hired. And I got hired by a news service, the Hearst Wire Service. I'm sure none of our listeners know what that is, but it was sort of a, you know, there was competition with the Associated Press and news gathering. And I went to work as a copy boy doing the scut work of the newsroom. And the summertime came and vacations started, and they gave me little things to do. And they edited what I did, and I slowly learned what the newspaper business was all, what the journalism business was about.
What are some of the things that you learned from those original days in your career that stick with you today as the chairman at the Chicago Sun-Times?
Well, one of the important things is recognizing what a story's about. One of the problems we have now, since newspapers are not necessarily the first at the news story, is that you get lots of news writers who are busy saying, as the sun rose over the Lake
right.
Michigan.
It's a busy yes. day on Western Avenue.
Yeah,
right,
you know,
right, right.
instead of, you know, the mayor of the city of Chicago called the governor his old buddy, a no-good SOB. That, you know, it's very hard now sometimes to deal with writers and journalists who didn't go through that process.
Because they're more they come from a background of maybe more descriptive writing. They haven't grown up on the nuts and bolts like you did in the copy
rooms. That's right. And they don't know how to take the high when, you know, the where, went, why into the modern circumstance, which is that you're writing what we called, when I was a copy boy, a second day lead. What that meant then was that you were writing the story for the afternoon paper about something that the morning paper had already reported on. Sound familiar?
Yeah,
just
right,
like the
right.
problem now that you read it on the web and you're reading the next day's story. I learned how to write second-day leads.
Well, doesn't the current climate encourage young journalists to learn about second-day leads? Because essentially it's there, like you just said. I mean, you're going to hear about the story all day long, as opposed to once in the morning paper, once in the afternoon.
Yeah, yes, it does. In fact, the journal I worked at Northwestern on a pro bono basis, helping them to bring the lessons into the modern era, and what were the questions? You know, do you write for a print vehicle the same as you write for the web? No, you don't. Do you write for the phone the same way you write for the web? No, you don't, because of the differences in what the eyes can see and how the material is approached by the reader. These are very complicated issues. So the whole question of a second-day lead is now, you know, very difficult and very complicated.
Well, let's talk about making that transition from being a journalist to being a owner and a manager. I mean, let's jump to the Southtown, you know, the Economist, those papers that really were the lifeblood of the South suburbs, Southwest suburbs. Talk about your time there and what you learned about newspapers from an ownership standpoint.
Well, you learned that newspaper material is very much personal, that it's very much about people, that it's very much birth, marriage, and death, and that those are the stories which people want to read, not only about themselves, but about the rest of the world. The community press is a very interesting phenomenon in the sense that it developed in the major metropolitan areas of the U.S., into these rather lively local newspapers that deal very heavily in material that you get nowhere else, by the way. That's another factor, even today. So, I mean, even in the Hyde Park Herald, which is, you know, when atomic energy was not such a bad word, we used to have a slogan at the Hyde Park Herald, which was that when the atomic bomb falls on 60th Street, that's not news. The fallout on 59th Street is news, because that was the Hyde Park boundary. And Woodlawn was on the other side, and we didn't cover Woodlawn. And that's still true.
It is, but you see, I mean, what we saw in the last 5 years of the Sun-Times was was a move more towards a national network, to headlines that were going to be broad, that anybody could read about celebrities, about news that was happening national. But there seemed to be, even though you have some great talent and some great stuff and did get some great journalists local, there seemed to be a little bit more of a push away from the idea of it being about Chicago, about community.
You'll notice that we're not doing that now. Okay, that bespeaks to, we tried an experiment that didn't work. Everybody's got the same problem in journalism today. How do you support the journalism? Which means, how do you have an economic model that works? And we're constantly experimenting with that. And what became clear to us is that if we have a role to play, it's here in the city of Chicago. That we're not going to be a second newspaper covering the world.
How do you deal with, you know, obviously the big sell-off of the suburban newspapers and suburban coverage diminishing under the last regime? How do you deal with regional coverage, suburban coverage, not just Chicago, the city of Chicago, but the Sun-Times being a voice for some of the communities in here that aren't in Cook County or in central Cook County?
Well, we're still a strong suburban newspaper. Half our circulation is in the suburbs. The realities are that what people want to know about is the city, even if they live, you know, they may want to know what's happening in Oak Park, and there are two newspapers out there to tell them. What they want to know from us is what's happening in City Hall, where is the police problem, where is the fight between the mayor and the governor. And we have, as you can see from looking at the paper, we are focused on those issues, on the politics, on city governments, on what's happening in the state on a statewide basis where it's relevant to Chicago. It's the same old hook. And that's clearly where our strength is. That's clearly what our readers want. And it's also clearly what we're good at.
Bruce Sagan is the chairman of the board of the Chicago Sun-Times. He's my guest tonight at the big table. We'll continue our conversation after the news. Stay with us. Welcome back to The Download here on WGN Radio. My guest tonight at the big table, Bruce Sagan, the chairman of the board of the Chicago Sun-Times, who was appointed to that job earlier this year after Michael Farrell left the newspaper to take over at the Chicago Tribune. The one piece that stands out is that Neil Steinberg piece about you speaking to the Sun-Times staff the day that you took over. And you talked about Michael Farrell, who's now your primary competition at the Chicago Tribune. And Neil has you quoted as saying, you made a mistake. You're talking to the staff. You educated him. He came here, a rich guy who didn't know anything about journalism. The rich dabbler got the message from you.
Well, he learned about journalism. And he learned a fundamental truth of the present situation. Namely, that people are stealing our journalism. And they're making money from it. The Googles of the world are making money from our journalism, for which they don't pay. And Farrow, who's very bright and understands information, clearly said to himself, the Sun-Times is not big enough to make a dent in this problem. We need an organization that's large enough, that has a large enough content to be able to carry on what clearly is a war over who gets paid for the journalism. That's what's going on
and
now
how, on a national basis. But how do you at the Sun-Times, knowing that that's the issue, and Michael Farrow has recognized that and he's moved on to find a bigger content distribution,
yeah.
How do you fit in? How does the Sun-Times fit in? How does the Chicago Reader fit in when it comes to having content that people will pay for?
Well, they both have content people will pay for. They do, in fact, they pay for the Sun-Times now and try not issuing a copy of the Reader to see what your phone does. I mean, the realities are that both of these enterprises produce content that people want. Our problem is that the content can be stolen, used elsewhere, right. And the changes in the internet in terms of retailing generally have changed the economic patterns of advertising. If you can directly get your kind of customer through the internet, yep, which is becoming more and more possible, what does that mean? It means that you don't need the newspaper. Well, that's what's occurring, let's face it.
Well, I mean, so, that's, Facebook, and those are, that's what you're talking about, is the way that they're skimming, that you can put up a Sun-Times piece and it opens in Facebook and there's ads that are served for Facebook.
Right.
You're not getting anything off of it.
But at some point, we're going to stop Facebook from doing
that. How do you do that? How does the Sun-Times do that?
I think there is going to be a copyright problem
comes in
and a copyright fight that's going to make the it's going to make the music business one look like child's play. Because journalism has the problem of fair use, which means that people can use some of the journalism in certain circumstances without paying for it. So there is going to be an enormously complicated fight over copyright. And Farrow is absolutely right. I'm going to have that fight, and I need a big organization to do it. The Sun-Times can't afford that argument.
Being a newspaper guy in the city of Chicago and watching what's happening with the takeover argument about Gannett taking over Trunk. What do you think, as someone who's been in the seat of both the person who's taken over and being taken over, like, what do you think of a company coming outside of Chicago to try and take over the Chicago Tribune?
Well, obviously I like local ownership. Our effort at the Sun-Times is all the guys who went into Rapports, they're not even journalists. They're simply believers in multiple voices, as multiple journalistic voices in the city. And there's surprisingly some very rich people in town who said, we got to see that this maintains itself. And recognizing that the second newspaper has been lost in a number of cities, they collectively said, let's see if we can't keep this second voice, if we can't figure out how to keep the runway long enough that as news generation and the paying for news develops on the internet, we have multiple voices.
Well, the deal's not dead necessarily, but if Gannett did take over the Chicago Tribune, you already have a relationship with Gannett with the USA Today insets that are in the newspaper.
Yes.
Would that have to change if Gannett came in and took over the Chicago Tribune?
I don't know. Conceivably, if Gannett owned the Chicago Tribune, they would want the Gannett News we're running to run in the Tribune, mm-hmm. and the Sun-Times would have a problem. There are ways for us to reproduce that. I mean, I would be unhappy because the Gannett thing is very efficient on national and international news, where we no longer have bureaus all over the world. Mm-hmm. And so it's a very efficient circumstance, and it's very good. They do it very well, and I'm pleased to have it. So I'd be sorry to lose it, but we would replace it.
The Chicago Sun-Times, you know, is such a favorite, especially when it comes to local journalists. So many people who've worked for the paper who have wanted to have a say in how the newspaper is playing out and with the future direction. Yes. Not too long ago, there was a very robust conversation about from Brian over at New City saying, you know, this is what I would do with the newspaper.
Yeah.
I mean, a lot of that surrounded the Chicago Reader, which is also owned by the Chicago Sun-Times holding company. Do you foresee the Chicago Reader continuing the way that it is, that it's an alt-weekly that is together but is a separate entity? It's in the Chicago Sun-Times. Or do you see a future in which both of those brands are merged?
No, I hope they are separate brands and stay. At this point, I have no reason to know, you know, what the future will be. Tell me what 15 years from now looks like in the journalism profession. The fact of the matter is that the Reader is an old voice in Chicago, one that has been important in the cultural affairs of the city for many, many years. It just did an enormously important mm-hmm. story about
abuse,
a problem over a theater company in town. I mean, you know, that's irreplaceable for this city. And therefore, if we have anything to do with it, the Reader's going to continue as a separate institution. We're happy to sell advertising together, however, but they're going to have separate voices.
You've said a couple times now, you know, in the future, 10 years, 15, 20 years in the future. From your standpoint as an owner, as somebody who's been in newspapers for over 50, 60 years, where do you see it going? I mean, do you feel like you have a good understanding, or are you, like everybody else, just like, where it goes? Let's jump in the pool and see where it goes.
Yeah, no, I think I know where it's going. I don't know how to get there. Where it's going is that you will pay on the web for the news you consume. I send you a story and I say to you, you got to read this from, XYZ. You'll go to XYZ and you'll pay them a quarter. because you'll hit a button, right? And I'll say to you, you got to see today's Tribune. You'll go to their site and you'll buy today's web paper.
Like we talked about, like being able to hit a button and automatically charge your card.
And can I point out to you that there's somebody who already does hit a button sales? Guess who?
Amazon?
Yeah, and guess what Amazon owns? The Washington Post.
Oh, okay, so they're on their way.
I couldn't tell you. They have been. I want you to know that the Washington Post has been deliberately building its website. They are pushing it out. You subscribe to the Sun-Times email paper, you get the Washington Post with it.
And I would think that you'd be following in the same footsteps of the way that the music industry has done it with not only streaming services where we see where maybe there's a way that the model is that you pay a certain amount a month, or if I want a certain song, I pay 99 cents. So you're saying
exactly,
news is going to be the same way.
Absolutely the same way. You say to me, well, how can this happen? The New York Times now has over a million web-only subscribers. When the New York Times was in its best shape in the 1980s, say, it had a whole million and a half circulation. Now it had more readers because pass-along print is a little different than the web.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so they may have had 2.5 million readers on time. I'm simply suggesting to you that they have already bridged the problem of news is free. They have said, in effect, ours isn't. Now, you can still get in there and steal it. You can still see lots of it. But the point is, they're making it work. And I would argue that that system is going to work its way all the way back to the Hyde Park Herald someday.
What seems to be standing in the way of this, and that's, I guess, at the current crux, is companies, social media companies, that recognize that they're going to be able to make money off of your content. Facebook, we've talked about it on this program, the way that they're able to open up the article inside of Facebook. Snapchat, another, you just see that more and more news services are being provided to Snapchat, to the kids who are on Snapchat. So it does seem like the war is not going to be between necessarily the Chicago Tribune and the Chicago Sun-Times. It's going to be the Chicago Sun-Times versus Facebook.
Absolutely right. And from my point of view, that's just fine. Because my interest is in how do you pay the journalists? And if we can have a copyright fight that says, Snapchat, you can't run that, and Snapchat says, oh, wow, all right, I'll hire my own journalist.
Somebody
I got to tell you,
right.
Fine with me. I'm interested in newsroom. I'm interested in journalism in a democracy, and I'm interested in that being out there where everybody can find it. And I'm interested in an economic model that works.
You're 87 years old.
Yes.
Are there I mean, you're owning a Chicago Sun-Times, which essentially has to turn into a digital portal, which is really the future of new media as we know it. Do you feel, and I say this in the most respectful way possible, do you feel like you're equipped for that with the experience you've had, the 60 years plus? Or, I mean, do you surround yourself with people who may understand the or more indigenous to the web?
I have the question of, am I going to survive to the point, which is part of the point at issue. The reality is that everybody understands the problem, that nobody knows how to quite get there. So we're not going to be the leader at the Sun-Times, which is essentially what Farrow recognized, that he had something there that wasn't big enough to make the thing move. And so he's gone to where it's bigger. Would I like to be bigger? Sure. But I'm interested in that second voice in Chicago. I've been here in Chicago journalism for, you know, I have to tell you, I was fortunate to work at City News Bureau. I mean, I'm one of the last of the breed who went through that process of copy boy to City News. And the first time I went looking for a job, I went to the Chicago Sun-Times in 1953, and they turned me down.
So it's full circle. Now you own the thing. Maybe this has been just a huge vendetta for you.
Yes, of course. I'm getting even.
Well, I mean, do you have plans at 87 years old? Do you have plans to see this through? I mean, are you thinking about retirement? I mean, what's the future for Bruce Sagan?
The future for Bruce Sagan is to last as long as he can, helping the Sun-Times find ways to use what I've learned in the print end of the business to make the print end as stable as it can, where I can be very helpful, and to help them move to the web, but recognizing that we're not the leaders of that parade. We're going to pick up what somebody else has done successfully. What we have to do is preserve the brand. And that's something I do know something about over many years of creating brands. And it's important that we do that to buy the time to keep that brand in everybody's mind so that as the problem of paying journalists and where you get your journalism from works its way down through the process from the biggest, New York Times, Wall Street Journal, to the, you know, the next level at the Tribune.
You can say it. Trunk.
I can't quite get there. To the, you know, all the way down to the bottom of the pile where something like the Hyde Park Herald exists.
Bruce Sagan is the chairman of the board at the Chicago Sun-Times. He's also the publisher of the Hyde Park Herald. He's been doing that for 63 years. Bruce Sagan, thanks so much for being my guest tonight at the Big Table.
You're welcome.
It's a download here on WGN Radio. Coming up, we're going to talk to some people from the Victory Gardens Theater. I'm very excited to talk with Isaac and Lizanne. Both Lizanne Mitchell is a big-time actress who is performing at the Victory Gardens. We'll talk with her about the show they're doing. Fascinating stuff. Coming up at 9:30, we're going to talk with Naz Khan and Sean Miller, husband and wife team that are putting together the feature film The Replacements, a dark comedy about the first clone president. Drones are so yesterday. That's so 2016. This is the future. Clones are bigger than drones. So that'll be coming up in the 9 o'clock hour. We'll talk with them about that. And at 10 o'clock hour at Studio 435, the congregation in studio. Bob is here. He's setting up. This is an eight-piece. There are horns. Pete, do you do this just to mess with Bob? Is it some sort of game?
Wait till Mukapatsa comes in down the line, 45-member band.
That's going to be the best. They all have to come in, too. None of this tripping it down. I heard you talk to Bob. He's like, either all or none. We don't want like four of the guys to just come in and talk and spin the CD. Mukapatsa's got to bring the whole kit and caboodle. Yeah, I'm excited about Studio 435 tonight. I've always been a fan of the congregation. We were just talking. I saw them at Subterranean probably a decade ago.
Nice.
Yeah, and we have a lot of interesting ties between the musicians and some people I know, people who recorded their first record.
So, cool.
Yeah, so I'm excited to talk to them. It's going to be fun to have them here. Bruce Sagan, huh? And it's funny because most of the texters, and this is going to be an issue for Bruce and for the Sun-Times and for the news industry altogether. The responses. You ready for this? Mm-hmm. I got multiple of the same theme. Yeah, but I get it for free now. Talking about the news.
Right.
Yeah, but I get it for free. And someone even said, while I was listening to your guest, I Googled Trump something. And I was able to get 15 articles about the same thing free. From different places. Why would I pay for it?
That's certainly true. I mean, I do the same thing. You know, come across a paywall. I'm like, I can find it somewhere else. But eventually, it's all going to be like that. And there's going to be certain. There's that. It's a commercial from like the live blog. We had like the ads.
Oh, for our own site?
The ads that are running.
If you do not know, on WGNRadio.com, we run a live blog every night. It shows pictures and tweets and extra stuff and all these Facebook Live stuff that Pete does. But it also has live ads that play when Pete's trying to update it. That's funny.
So, but there are certain columnists that I want to read on a daily basis. And like Mr. Sagan pointed out, you know, if I want to read it, I'll spend a quarter.
Well, there was what I do think is interesting is there was a time in our world where newspapers were not free. They were, you know, you go back to the 50s and 60s, you did not get your news for free. You know, you paid money and nobody had qualms with that.
Yep.
there wasn't this sort of backlash, like, but I wish I could steal this paper. Like, it was a thing. And the news, and, you know, and people didn't, you know, sort of rebel against it.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't until the internet and maybe a false move by the industry, or maybe a misstep by saying, what if we gave the news for free and paid banner ads and advertising around it would pay for it.
Mm-hmm.
And now that that's not enough money for them, and I'm not saying that they're greedy, but I don't know that obviously the advertising industry has not played along with newspapers and media. So what does that mean? At what point do they have to say we have to rethink the whole way? Because the music industry did something similar. Now, granted, it was Napster finding a way to give music for free.
Mm-hmm.
You know, now I was able to get an MP3 and be like, oh, before I ethically had any problem with it. But they adjusted. You know, I have to go essentially, you know, dark web to get, you know, free music. But, you know, in terms of Apple Music or Spotify, they figured out ways to, you know, put a stream together. So that's essentially a subscription. Mm-hmm. The news business is not that far behind. What I find totally interesting about what Bruce was talking about is Michael Farrow garnering enough, or gathering, might be a better question, gathering enough strength to essentially start a legal battle against companies like Facebook and Snapchat. I never thought of it like that before. Is that what this is about? If he's going after saying, you can't put my article on mm-hmm. Facebook anymore.
It's going to be a copyright fight.
Which is not how it's been couched in the media. It's been couched more like, well, you know, as Facebook and they're almost symbiotic. You know, as a matter of fact, I mean, you have to put certain code in your website if you're the Chicago Tribune to let, or the Sun-Times, to let the Facebook be able to skin it and put it on the mm-hmm. site. So it's just interesting that, like, that will be something that plays out and might be a turning point in the industry as we know it coming up. Bruce Sagan here on The Download. All right, coming up, we got so much great stuff. We're at the halfway point of the show. Stay with us. It's a download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, the new play, The House That Will Not Stand, is on stage at the Victory Gardens through July 10th. It's a new play from resident playwright Marcus Gardley, directed by Che Yu. Che's been a guest at the big table here on The Download. It's set in New Orleans, circa early 19th century, and it focuses on a free woman of color, Beatrice, who's in a left-handed marriage with a white man. In the play, the man dies, the laws change, and Beatrice is caught in the middle. Beatrice is played by award-winning actress Lizanne Mitchell. She's been the star of stage and screen, everything from Broadway to the Victory Gardens to soap operas. She was on Guiding Light. She starred in The Preacher's Wife. She was on television shows like The Good Wife and Law and Order. And she's worked with playwright Marcus Gardley before. Lizanne Mitchell, good to have you here.
Wonderful to be here. Thank you for having me.
To have you. Also joining me tonight, Isaac Gomez. Isaac is the director of new play development at the Victory Gardens and helped bring this play to the stage. Isaac, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
So let's talk about this. I mean, it's an interesting play and really takes on, and I kind of said it in the beginning, this idea of left-handed marriage. What does that mean?
I think when whoever are the ruling class put together systems of law that benefit them. So in this particular case, we're talking about Louisiana. We're talking about in the early 1800s, and we're talking about very wealthy, rich, white men, usually of French descent or of Spanish descent. And they kind of have their cake and eat it. They have a white wife, and there's another class of women that came up who were products of black and white parentage. Louisiana, when it started off, did not have very many available white women, so the French men there tended to mate with enslaved women or indigenous women, Indian women. And out of these unions came these children who were a combination of both races, and they almost became another kind of class and were treated differently. And in order for them not to be enslaved, they set up a system called placage, where arranged marriages took place, and they weren't really marriages, but they were kind of close to that, where this mixed race, beautiful young woman was in contract, in a contract that was put together by her mother with a wealthy white man where she would be taken care of, her children would be taken care of, and the mother would be taken care of. This was all based on color. Mm-hmm. And I really feel that this play is extra important because it talks about the roots of why we separate according to color and why.
What attracted you to it? I mean, for you, you've done a lot of great theater. I mean, your resume is tremendous. What attracted you? I mean, was it working with Marcus again, or was it the roots of this play?
I think both. There has never been a role that I know of that has been in theater like this particular role. This is an extremely strong woman, very self-aware, and she's revolutionary in how she wants her daughters to be more free than she was. And Marcus has this extraordinary talent to write for women. There are no males in this play.
This is a full African-American female cast.
A full African-American.
And you've been in theater a while now. Mm-hmm. That's not something that you see, even when there are plays where the roles are specifically for women. They're like, well, let's have guys play. There seems a lot that goes on. But this is something that's very unique for theater.
It's very unique for theater. The things are changing, though. I just saw Eclipsed on Broadway, which had an all African-American cast of women in it, too. But Marcus is extraordinary in the way that he can almost like embody all these different kinds of women, because my daughters are very young. They're ingenues. They're like, you know, older teenagers of today. And the voice he gives to them is so authentic. I'm much older, of course. I'm their mother. And that voice is authentic, too. It's uncanny.
For you, I mean, how important is it as an actress to find plays that do have authentic voice? Because that's something that obviously speaks to you as an actress. But is it easy to find that, or is it hard to find?
It's really hard to find because most of the times things are written to please audiences. So controversy, things that are provocative, are not usually done with authenticity. Marcus is such a fabulous storyteller that it almost sneaks up on you how authentic he is being.
Well, there's something great about this play, the idea that it's not just, you know, it's set in, like we said, early sort of 19th century New Orleans. But Marcus seems to do wonders with the sort of contemporary telling of it, the idea of using contemporary language, even pop culture references, things of that nature. Isaac, let's bring you into the conversation. As the director of New Play Development, you know, where are you finding not only your resident playwrights, but you know, the subjects and the content for Victory Gardens?
Absolutely. I think the best way I describe the work we do at Victory Gardens is that we produce plays that ask incredibly hard questions with no easy answers.
That's theater.
It is. Right? Well, I mean,
hopefully.
You know, yeah, right, I think it depends. But for us, taking it to the next level is telling stories of underrepresented groups and communities, breaking open incredibly controversial and deeply provocative themes, and asking our audiences to challenge their deepest convictions. For writers like Marcus, who is a huge history buff, a large bulk of his body of work is centered on moments of history that did not make the American history books, and moments in history that give voices to people who otherwise would not have their stories told. And so when it comes to The House That Will Not Stand specifically, it's the story centering on this group of empowered women, resilient despite the circumstances around them, positioned in a place and time where they were failing and yet still rising above. And even over the last few performances with our audiences, seeing how much that transcends to a contemporary setting and how that story resonates still true for audiences today, especially for people of color.
How, I mean, for you at the Victory Gardens, how important is it to be able to bring those hard questions to an audience? And in all honesty, are they responding to it? I mean, how are audiences responding to not just this play, but other plays at Victory Gardens where they're asking very tough questions or exposing issues that don't necessarily make it to the dinner table?
Right. No, it's true. And what I love about Chicago audiences is how excited they are by challenging questions, at least in my experience. And in terms of Victory Gardens and the work that we do, our audience responses are incredibly polarizing in a really beautiful and intricate way. We have our older, predominantly upper middle class white patron base who ask very well-meaning questions and wondering how and why certain things are happening the way they are. And then our younger, more diverse patrons who are saying, this is my life, so we don't need to inquire deeply about it. It's just, it is what it is. And what's so beautiful about what our shows provide is an opportunity for that conversation to exist in places where it probably never would have. And we're not here to give the answers, but what we can do is provide a platform to have the discussion.
Lizanne, let me bring you back in, because for you as an actress, are you seeking out pieces of writing, plays that are going to have those kind of at the heart challenging questions, hard things that, audiences, you know, don't necessarily have the answers for, versus, you know, finding parts that are going to be of a different ilk?
I'm so glad you asked that, because I was thinking about this, and I have been thinking about this almost all my acting career. I think it's so important when you have the attention of all these people to be about saying something that's going to mean something. Mm-hmm. And so I've had very good fortune in having the kinds of roles that speak to the truth, but are enshrouded in a great story. Because people don't want to be banged over the head with how they're supposed to think. But I think ever since the beginning, sitting around a campfire involved in a great story, you just get pulled in, you know, and you want to participate, and you want feedback about it, and you want to know what's going to happen next. And before you know it, a conversation can take place easily, because the play is the conduit of the truth.
For you, you know, you've done, I mean, just looking at your resume, I mean, you 30, 40, 50 play. I mean, it's a great career. For you, are you seeking out those kind of roles at this point? I mean, are you looking for those kind of texts? Or are you still, as many actresses and many actors in the world, just sort of, you know, going where the parts are?
No, I think, you know, always for me, being able to be authentic has been really, really important. And, you know, when you think about who you are and why you are here on this planet, what your gift is and what is going to make life meaningful for you, and you get to do it through something you love doing, like acting in plays, it's like a dream come true. It is not always manifested in a lot of money, but the personal growth and gratification that I've gotten from being able to tell what life is about through this means has been priceless.
As in, just as, have you grown in that role? Like, I'm thinking of you as a young actress coming out of school. Was that always the thought, where you're like, okay, I want to do something. I want to affect this. I want to affect an audience member. Or is that something that you've grown with in your career?
You know, ever since I was little, I was always impressed by the power of sound. And that sound is one of those kinds of energies that transcends walls. It affects your whole being. And even when I was little, I would hear certain actresses' voices, because I've known I wanted to act a long time. And I actually trained myself from a little girl to kind of lower my voice and to grab a hold to certain words that almost tell you what they mean by how they sound. And so to be able to take that and tell a story, I mean, I get more out of it than the audience sometimes.
That's good to hear. Isaac, let's turn to, I mean, you wear many hats at Victory Gardens, one of which is director of public programs. You know, there's a lot of talkbacks. There's a lot that goes on beyond the play at Victory Gardens. And one thing that Che has brought to them, we talked about it when he was on the show, about this idea of making theater much more immersive, that it's not just about what's on stage. It's the talkbacks afterwards. It's the programs around. When it comes to this play, when it comes to The House That Will Not Stand, what are you doing to create a full, complete story around the play?
Absolutely. I think what's really fun about creating our public programs is it starts with deconstructing the plays based on their themes and then reconstructing them through ideas and references in which most people are already accustomed to experiencing in their day-to-day life to make theater that much more relevant to what you're seeing on the street. And so for The House That Will Not Stand, I mean, this play's existed for a few years now. And when Marcus talks about this play, it's so beautiful because he speaks about it as his love letter to Black women, to the Black women in his life, especially his grandmothers who are from New Orleans. And as we were prepping for this play, Beyoncé's visual album Lemonade dropped, and she calling that her love letter to Black women. And the immense amount of Black female empowerment that comes from this play is something that a lot of theaters are hard. They may not embrace that as widely as we do. And so these concepts of Black girl magic and having pre-show Reiki and spiritual healing and divination and live artistry featuring Black female performers to perform in our lobby before The House That Will Not Stand, to town hall discussions centering on Black women in theater and the lack of representation of them, to post-show conversations centering on colorism and free women of color movement and all these areas that are seldom explored, or to even the representation of sexuality among Black women, and in which ways are they fetishized, in which ways are they not. And so embracing that has been, at least in the response that we've received over the last few days, has been incredible. There's a deep, deep yearning for Black women to have a platform to live their lives, speak their truth, and live in self-love. And we're thrilled that this play can be a platform for that.
As a Black actress, have you seen more opportunity as 2016 than you did, say, 10 years ago in your career, or even 15, 20 years ago? I mean, are you seeing more opportunity for women of color on the stages across America?
Absolutely. I can remember stopping for 6 years because the roles were so demeaning. I couldn't perform them and live with myself. So a friend of mine, you know, saw me in Atlanta and said, "You've stopped acting. I cannot believe that." And she caused me to come back, you know, because she said, "You know, things are so much better now." I had really given
just because the parts were just, like you said, demeaning.
Yeah, I can remember, like, I came up in the South, and the school that I went to, the high school that I went to, we weren't allowed to participate in theater unless we played slaves or maids. So, you know, if the play didn't involve that, you didn't have the opportunity to even perform. So when, you know, I got to college and was performing, my teachers were shocked. They said, "Oh, we didn't know." I said, "No, of course you couldn't have known."
So, I mean, for you, I mean, working with Marcus, having a chance to do it again, to sort of be inspired and to participate and collaborate with an artist, a playwright like Marcus, do you see yourself gravitating towards that, like finding playwrights that speak to you or that speak for you as an actress and gravitating to those kind of roles develop a relationship with a playwright?
Absolutely. I mean, but, you know, that's been my way all the time. And I really don't like to, this is rare for me to do a play over. I like to do new work. I don't like to do revivals, any of that. But this play gets richer and richer and richer, and Marcus has come in. I didn't think he could make it better, but he has rewritten whole sections of this play, and he has deepened my character till I love her more than I ever did before. She's very strong, and she can be considered mean and all of those kinds of things, but the love she has in her heart and how that love manifests is just unbelievable, and it's written at, this is Marcus's real grandmother. So I'm not portraying somebody fictional. Maybe time-wise I am, but in reality I am modeled after his grandmother. So I have to live up to that.
Lizanne Mitchell is the star of the show The House That Will Not Stand at the Victory Gardens. It's Marcus Gardley's play. It's running till July 10th. Thank you for being here. We appreciate
thank
you talking
you so
about
much
it.
For having
also,
us.
Isaac Gomez, Director of New Play Development at Victory Gardens. Good luck with the show.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
All right, welcome back to Download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Cobbin. Sorry about that. We've got the live band, Studio 435, doing a little sound check in studio. Oh, how's everybody doing out there? So we're up here till 11 o'clock till Patty Vasquez takes over with Pretty Late with Patty Vasquez. I'm Justin Cobbin. All right, a new dark comedy feature film is in the works from the husband-wife team of Sean Miller and Naz Khan. It's called The Replacement, and it takes place in the not-too-distant future. It focuses on the story of the first clone president. The Replacement is currently fundraising and has a Kickstarter underway open till tomorrow. Actually, it's open for about 24 more hours. If they don't hit the goal, then we don't get a clone president, which that's not cool. Sean Miller and Naz Khan are joining me along with the clone president, Mike McNamara. Good to see everybody.
Hey.
Thanks for having us on here. Thank you for that. You can get to the Kickstarter at thereplacementmovie.com. All right. So, Sean, let's start with you. This, when I say clone president, explain the premise of the movie you guys are working on.
Sure. So in our movie, we're set in a world where people basically get dozens of clones on a regular basis. It's just a normal thing. Mm-hmm. And so the special thing about these clones is you might get like dozens and dozens of Justin clones. And, you know, one goes off and pursues his career and, you know, as a professional athlete. One goes off and goes to medical school. One goes off and does, you know, he pursues guitar. You know, he finally sees what will come out of it. And all of them, you know, they can memory share. That's the special thing about them. So the guy who gets like the medical degree, now the guy who knows guitar, like he's a doctor as well. And the guy who's a rock star, he's also got the medical degree and all that type of stuff. So what happens is progress starts to move really, really fast. Mm-hmm. You know, these clones are just like a godsend. You know, diseases are getting cured, the stock market's flying up and everything. The problem is, if you, Justin, you know, you the natural-born guy, you don't have any of this memory-sharing right. stuff. So you start to get outsourced by your own clones. You kind of get left right. behind.
I'm flawed.
Yeah. So that's kind of our movie follows, like, a guy who's, he's watching all of his clones go on to bigger and better things constantly, and yet he's kind of left behind. And finally, he sees his own clone get elected as the first president.
It's very sci-fi, and I like it in the way that I feel like I've seen this premise, or I feel like I know this premise from watching kids' movies on Nickelodeon. Which there's like a kids, and I'm glad you're doing it. There's a kids' movie where the main guy, I know I have an 8-year-old.
Okay.
And he but then it goes wrong. And you're like, all right. So I'm glad that someone's doing the adult version of it. Naz Khan, are you a science fiction fan? I mean, what attracts you to a script like this?
My husband. I was always interested in sci-fi movies, but I never thought that I would be part of one. I've been pursuing filmmaking for a decade in Chicago. This is my first sci-fi movie. It's all because of Sean.
Sean, let me ask this question. I mean, how hard is it when it's one thing to write a sci-fi script?
Sure.
But it's another to shoot a sci-fi movie, because when you get involved with shooting sci-fi, there has to be some sort of dystopian, you know, new skyline. There needs to be a lot of CG, I'm assuming. There has to be a lot of things that sort of represent a world that we don't know.
The flying cars, the alien invasions, all that type of stuff, right? So for our movie, we're setting ourselves kind of in the near future. I mean, similar to like what you would see in like Gattaca or in Her, where it feels like it's just right around the corner. There's stuff that's definitely a little bit sci-fi in there, but it's stuff that's manageable on shooting on a low budget. And, you know, our biggest challenge is going to be doing clones. But the happy coincidence is people have been doing, like, twin effects, you know, mm-hmm. all the way since, like, Charlie Chaplin. It's, like, it's not that hard to do it using body doubles, using, like, split screen, that type of stuff. And we're gonna use all these old sheets plus new stuff, new technology, where we can do, like, holographic, you know, displays and do motion control cameras so we can have a camera move and have, you know, Mike, you know, like in 30 mics in the same room, that type of stuff.
Let's turn the conversation. Yeah, just what Mike needs,
yeah.
right? Mike McNamara, you're known, you know, as the man behind the Chicago Midwest Film Festival.
Yep.
Talk about the idea of being an actor in this film and how you got involved in this.
Yeah, well, it's fun because, you know, I start, you know, my primary career is as an actor in Chicago, film, theater, all that stuff. And then the Midwest Independent Film Festival kind of just came through that, just because there was a need to celebrate all the talent we have here in Chicago. So it's cool to see everything kind of come together here. And now we have a, you know, these are folks that I actually met on a film set as an actor like 5 or 6 years ago in Niles, Michigan, which not Niles, Illinois, Niles, Michigan. It's trashy brother. It's the trashy brother that's hooked on heroin of, yeah, Ned, of Niles,
it is.
Illinois.
Hey, this is WGN. Niles, Michigan is getting this. So they're like, oh, never again. We don't want
getting in our cars.
You know, sorry, Niles.
It's just all opinions here only reflect my opinion. I had a great time in Niles, Michigan, but let's just call it what it is. All right, so it's cool to see this all come together, and there's other folks actually that we've shown. That there's the cinematographer is a guy named Mike Bove. He had a wonderful film that he shot called Uncle John that was at South by Southwest and was our best feature winner at the Midwest Independent mm-hmm. Film Festival last year, and now he's the DP for this film. So it's kind of a tribute to the Chicago film community and how it's growing and how it's really on this upslope right now and really rising quickly. It's because everyone is starting to jump together and pitch in on each other's productions. And someone who's a DP on this one might be first AC on another one. Someone who's doing sound on this one might be directing another one. Everyone's starting to pitch in and jump together. And that's really what the key is to building a great film society here in the city.
Sean, you've done a lot of short films in your career. You've done some stuff. For you to move to a different kind of, to bring this together, to do this kind of film, what does it take to take it to the next level?
I mean, so if we're doing like a sci-fi, like you said, it's a little bit more difficult. But in some ways, I've cut my teeth on doing like a lot of action adventure stuff, like right out the gate, like car chases, big explosions, that type of stuff, and doing it like on a micro budget where we're just asking favors and, you know, figuring stuff out on our own and doing that. So we kind of have like already had a trial by fire. In fact, even the movie we met Mike on is the movie we Nas and myself met on. It was a slasher film out in Niles, and it was a relationship, you know, built in fire, and you know, we learned very quickly how to handle tough situations. So for something like this, normally daunting to a lot of people, but we feel like we've got this pretty well covered.
No, it's okay. You guys, in the video you have on your Kickstarter page, you talk about not only what it's going to be, the film, but you talk about your experience in being able to create film in, like you just mentioned, like pressure situations, but also the fact that, you know, you can work on shoestring budgets. Mm-hmm. When you talk about a film set, what makes a film set hum when you don't have a lot of money?
Wearing multiple hats. Being able to do everything and anything that is required to get the job done. I've been a production designer, a producer, a craft services person, a makeup artist, everything on one shoot. Just yesterday we did this.
True. Yeah, we just, it's like she's being cloned.
Well, this is really just a sci-fi version of your life.
Pretty much.
Yeah, right.
It's just multiple hats. That's what you do. And you call in a lot of favors, you get some sponsors, and that's how it happens.
Where do you spend the money? As a layman who's never done film production, where does the bulk of that money that you want to raise on Kickstarter go to?
The stuff that, like, you would never think. Like, getting insurance for a location, like feeding your cast and crew. You can get tons of people to come volunteer their time, but you got to feed them. You know, you got to pay for their parking. You got to do all those type of things, and they really add up really, really quick. So in our movie, like a lot of our stuff is going to, we have a ton of volunteers. We've got awesome crew members. Our couple other producers who aren't here, Brian Levin and Boris Wexler, who are helping out with a ton of stuff. But a ton of our budget is going towards, you know, set decoration, towards the renting a location so that they can have a security guard stick around for us. It's really the boring things that all the money, you know, really goes towards. The cool things, we tend to either do it ourselves or we can find people we've worked with in the past to help out.
Of all the things that you've done on a film set, what do you consider your specialty? Like, what do you think is what's a Nas kind of specialty?
I was a production designer for a very long time, so this movie really intrigued me because it requires a lot of creative design and creative producing. Although with age, I can't be like painting rooms anymore. My back hurts, but
you got a bad back.
Yeah, but I've moved on to producing, and I think that is where it lies, to get everything in place for Sean, to make sure he has everything he needs in order to make this movie happen. I think that's where my power lies.
Mike, you know, for you, I mean, being at the Midwest Independent Film Festival, their story is one that you've encountered
right
a million times here in Chicago. Sure. The idea of this sort of, you know, small bootstrap production where everybody does everything. This is sort of how Chicago works.
This is how Chicago works. And productions like this need to be getting made in Chicago all the time. You know, now that we have a bunch of TV shows here, Chicago Fire, we've got Empire, Chicago PD. There's a couple other coming this summer. I think Transformers 12 or whatever is going to be here. Like that's putting food on people's tables to free them up to do these kind of passion projects. And that's really what's going to keep growing this community. So, and this is where you really get some amazing storytelling, because now you're really bringing some cool scripts that aren't going to get that $1-2 million budget and bring them to life.
Why right. Chicago? Why stay here? I mean, film production, film industry, film business, film opportunity is in industry towns. And when I mean L.A., New York City.
Yeah.
So talk about why you stay here as a filmmaker. I mean, it's obviously a harder road here in Chicago.
In some ways it is, but I love Chicago, and the filmmaking community is like a family. You have people who are willing to go that extra mile and really make it happen. And things that you can get in Chicago, you can't get in L.A. or New York. People know everything. You know, you go and shoot in the bar in L.A. and people will tell you, they're like, oh yeah, we know this whole song and dance. Over here, people are still excited and they're passionate about filmmaking.
I'm going to say it's easier to make a movie here than it is in L.A. We know the film community here. If we don't know one person, we know somebody who knows that person. Mm-hmm. We can get favors. We can make a $50,000 movie in $15,000 because we are locals to Chicago. And
you can't do that in L.A. They just won't let you do that in L.A.
No, right? They know the game. So they know what, you know, not to say like, you know, people are, you know, unaware of what something's worth, but you have people over here who are just passionate about it and still like it, and they haven't been, they're not cynics.
They're not jaded. In L.A., they're all jaded. Yeah, they're like, you want to use my convenience store? They're like, great, it's going to be $5,000.
They just pull up the index.
You've got Julia Roberts in your movie.
I've got the best story where I have one of those situations where my Gmail, it's someone keeps sending the wrong email to, you know, like everyone has that, like mcnamara right. @gmail. It's like, Matt, hey, Matt. And you're like, no, it's Mike. And like, I have this guy, he keeps sending, I think it's to his son, but he's doing the same in LA. He owns a house. Mm-hmm. I just know this all from never responding. I've never responded.
That's
but he
great.
Owns a house and they rent it out for films.
Yeah.
So he's always like, here's one, make sure that the writer and he attaches all these things. And I'm like, yeah, I'm like, this is just a guy and it's who's sending it to his son who has figured out the game of filmmaking in Los Angeles.
Yeah, it's business as usual.
It's really interesting. And I'm like, you got the wrong guy. But I feel bad for the guy who never gets this.
I cannot believe you have not jumped in on this email thread. I've been like, okay, sounds good, Chuck.
Sounds good, Chuck.
I'm going to see you 6:30 a.m. on Saturday.
So gotcha. Let's talk about the Kickstarter. I mean, this is obviously a way that many different art projects are now being funded.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
I mean, I feel like every other day we come in here, and even like big time, you know, we were talking with Dan Harmon and Dino Stamatopoulos talking about the movies and the stuff they do for Community and also for, what was it, Anomalisa?
Sure.
Yeah. But the idea that even the big people are using Kickstarter to be able to fund projects for you guys, is it an advantage to be able to crowdsource and be able to do it, or is it a necessity?
I mean, for us, it's a little bit of both. I mean, it's certainly an advantage where we have a big network of people that help out, and we really saw the opportunity in doing something like this to, instead of just, you know, doing a big Facebook blast over and over, hey, fund our film, we saw kind of an opportunity to like make kind of an interesting looking like set of commercials. I don't know if you saw them, but we basically put together like fake political campaign ads for the first clone president and for like buy your own clone. You know, we made these like cute little animated videos where, you know, it seems like this harmless thing. Hey, you know, it's like the new iPhone. So we kind of saw it as a challenge to do. But I mean, there's a struggle with it because like you're afraid of being like constantly annoying to all your friends and family. So we've done a very good job. We feel like we've done a pretty good job of just trying to keep it fresh and keep it new all the time.
I almost want to, like, after we're done with this 30 days, I want to do another 30 days campaign of saying, I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry. I annoyed you so much. I tagged you in every single thing. I'm so sorry. Do not defriend me. I love you all.
But we're almost there. It's 24 hours away. It's 80% funded. And there's some really cool perks that you can get. I mean, one, if you're listening and you were like, well, I'd love to have a producer credit on a film. I've always wanted to have, I mean, for, I think it's $250, you can get a producer credit on this film, which is, you know, usually it would be.
Start your IMDb.
Get that going.
Yeah. Right.
Or there's even a perk where you can be an extra on the film and your clone can be an extra on the film.
We'll clone you. That's enough right there. The idea that you'd be cloned, right?
Yeah.
Like, show up on a film set with your clone.
It's important, too, because Kickstarter's one of the crowdfunding platforms that if you don't get it, you don't get it.
It's all or nothing.
It's all or nothing, right?
Yeah, yeah.
We're 2,000 away. One more day left.
There you go. All right. So the website, again, is thereplacementmovie.com, right?
Yep,
that's it.
All right. Well, let's see. I hope you guys get it. Let me know if you do. I think that would be...
Sure.
Let's do it. Let's drive through, man.
Sean Miller and Naz Khan are the husband and wife couple that are putting together the movie The Replacement. They're fundraising right now at a Kickstarter. Mike McNamara, who's also the man behind the Midwest Independent Film Festival, is also acting. He's the president.
I'm the clone president. You're cloning me. There's going to be film festivals all over the damn country. Oh, wait, there already are.
Thanks, guys, coming in. Good luck with the Kickstarter.
Thanks so much.
Thanks so much.
Thanks.
It's a download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. Coming up, Studio 435. This is going to be big. I'm excited to have the band live, Studio 435, in studio. They're ready. I mean, this is sort of our thing now. You know, this will be the third week of Studio 435, where we expanded it. It was a half hour. Now we're going to an hour. I think I like it. It gives Bob a little bit more time to play, plug some stuff in.
A lot of plugs.
He plugs it in, he unplugs it, plugs it in again, unplugs it. It's good. I hope they get the Kickstarter on. That sounds good, the replacement.
Yeah, they're close.
That's a good story. That's what Chicago's going to win when it comes to filmmaking is to be able to go straight to the crowd, be able to do those kind of things. And we have heard a lot of stories, whether it be musicians or actors or filmmakers sort of wanting to fund their projects, their artistic projects. Maria Pinto.
Right.
We had her on last week, and that's all she talked about, Kickstarter to start her fashion, M2057. So there's a lot going on with crowdfunding here in Chicago. Chicago Cubs are down a run. Did you see this last play? Chris Bryant was able to hit the relay. And they were able to throw a guy out at home, and it was Wilson Contreras who made the tag at home. Very athletic play for a youngster. And then he came off the field all jacked up.
Yeah, he's an excitable one.
Yeah, he was all jacked up, and he was like, come on, let's go. Come on, let's go. And it was like, you know, like Chris Bryant had a little chuckle because he's like, you just got here. It's like your first day. This is game 100. We don't care if we win or lose. But he was super into it. They head into the bottom of the ninth now against the Cardinals closer down a run. But, man.
There was some criticism early in the game of Wilson Contreras. Not really, but, you know, from sports people that need something to complain about. It was like John Lackey has already given up 3 runs. It's got to be the Contreras catching them.
They blamed it on the catcher. Yeah. Like Lackey doesn't know how to pitch. He's 30-some-odd years old. What is it?
All wooden teeth?
All wooden teeth.
Yeah.
He's like, I don't know what this catcher said. Threw a fastball. Yeah, I don't buy that. So, I'm not a huge. I do like the Cubs. I'm not a huge John Lackey guy. There's just something. When he was on the Cardinals.
Yeah.
He's also a cowboy hat kind of guy. That's not my thing. When he was on the Angels, it's also like you forget he had a whole other life.
Yeah.
John Lackey had a whole life where he was on that Angels team that would always, with the Yankees and the Angels and the ALCS,
mm-hmm.
And you'd be like, there's Lackey in game seven. He was the ace for the Angels.
Yeah, that was a long time. I think right. it was in three.
And he might have had a Tommy John or something that, like, sidelined him, and he kind of was coming back, and it was like, oh, here he comes. He's trying. And then he went to the Cardinals. Oh, he's trying. Good to see he's trying. And then the last week I saw him. He had, like, 9 or 10 strikeouts.
He's been
dude's
good.
Back. Yeah, he's pitching
good
great.
For the, he was
and
good
I mean,
last year.
Say what you will. I mean, you're in the bottom of the ninth. They only gave up 3 runs.
Yeah,
quality
start.
Lackey was wild tonight. He was throwing all over the place, hit a guy. But they still only 3 runs. So.
Yeah, the Cubs pitching has been phenomenal. Like, they're starting pitching, I think I read somewhere, where it's using advanced metrics and stuff, you know, and tricks. It's been the best since 1900.
Do you believe in sabermetrics, Roger Badish?
Yeah, no. No. No.
No.
You give me a pitcher, you give me a batter. Anytime, it's going to be different. I don't care who it is.
All right.
I just don't believe in all the numbers and stuff and this and that. And I can imagine Madden over there with his little computer going crazy, going, yeah. Oh, you know, oh, we got an extra 0.1 percentage point on this guy. Hey, let's change the bullpen.
I wish baseball was more like football in that regard. Like, they would come off the field and they'd have Microsoft tablets. And they'd all be looking at it. And,
oh, please.
And there'd be a bunch of swiping, like, moving around. And, like, you know, and then, like, Chris Bryant just throws it to the side. He's sick of the tablet.
Yeah.
Like, I want that kind of thing. All right. All right, coming up, the congregation. Stay with us. It's a download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. All right, it's time for Studio 435. Our Monday night performance series featuring some of the best Chicago has to offer. Tonight's a treat. The rock, R&B, and soul outfit, The Congregation, are here in studio. The 8-piece band is going to be at Shake the Lake Festival in Madison, Wisconsin, this Saturday night. They're also going to be at Untitled. It's not an Untitled show. That's the name of the bar. Untitled on July 8th. Their latest album is called Record Collection, and they are in studio tonight. Gina Bloom, Charlie Wayne, Paul Pinkham, Steve Schuster, Dan Wendt, Nick Natoli, Justin Amolsch, and Eric Eisenman. Did I get everybody? Yeah. All right, good. They are here with the title track from their album, live in Studio 435. It's The Congregation with Record Collection. Take it away.
Only love me for my record collection. Say you never felt a deeper connection. Nothing gets you going like my motel stands. Record spinning, would you like it like that? We're hanging on while the red spins around. Love me for my records and you wanna get down. So just stay a while and have some fun with no mention. Thank you. deeper connection. He's got it all, Memphis, Philly, Detroit. Hey, we keep the records going all night, every night. We're hanging on by the West Mill Round. I love him for his records and I wanna get there.
All right. Live in Studio 435, it's The Congregation with the track Record Collection. It's their title track off their latest album, which is called Record Collection. Gina Bloom is on vocals, Charlie Wayne on guitar, Paul Pinkham on the keys, Steve Schuster on bass, Dan Wendt on drums, Nick Natoli on trombone, Justin Amulsh on trumpet, and Eric Eisenman on saxophone. They're going to be playing Shake the Lake Festival in Madison, Wisconsin this Saturday night. We're going to take a quick break, and we come back. We'll talk with you guys, and we'll hear some more music here on Studio 435. Stay with us. All right, in studio with me tonight, Studio 435, is The Congregation. Just heard them live in studio with the title track Record Collection and their latest album. Gina Bloom, Charlie Wayne, and Eric Eisenman are up on the microphones right now. Guys, thanks for being here. Thanks for performing. We appreciate it. Thanks for being here on WGN.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
So let's talk about the origins of the band. I mean, you guys have been around for, I would say, about a decade now, little give or take?
A little slightly less than a decade, but getting there. I think we first got together in 2009. It was kind of random. We met at a bar.
It's all good relationships.
I was going to say there's eight of you, and you're like, God, I wish I knew a trombone player. You're like, oh, I'm right here. Oh, my God, if we had a drummer, oh, right here.
The trombone player actually came a little bit later, but it actually, at the time, Charlie, our guitar player, Dan, our drummer, they were playing in a country band together, and I was...
Sawbuck.
Shout out to Sawbuck. I was singing and playing drums in a random cover band. We rehearsed at the same rehearsal space, and they put on a showcase of bands that rehearsed there. So we ended up, our bands randomly got put on the same gig together, and Charlie and Dan had been talking about putting together a soul band and were looking for a singer, and they happened to walk into a bar and find one that night.
Charlie, let me ask you, what was your, I mean, you're playing in a country band, what was your sort of attraction to soul music?
Well, yeah, so Dan, our drummer, our bass player at the time, Joe, and I had been talking for a while about doing a soul thing. You know, we were really into, especially like the Stax era, the late 60s Stax era stuff. But we kind of thought it was an impossible task. We're never going to find a singer, and you need the right singer to do that sort of band. You can't just throw anyone up there. And then during sound check, Gina's behind the drum kit, you know, she's singing Heard It Through the Grapevine. And like, we just look at each other and like, well, there, that's our problem solved. And we kind of drew straws, and I got short or long, depending on how you look at it. So I had to go ask Gina if she wanted to do this. I worked up courage, and at the end of the night, I think it was about bar time, and asked her if she wanted to, you know, come play with a Stax era soul band, and
she's
she
like,
did.
She's like, terrible game, dude.
Yeah, yeah. I don't have
heard
any,
that line a million times.
I'm not smooth. No, you know. Yeah.
You know, beyond when you say that kind of music, you need the perfect singer. And you know, talk about bringing the band together, because it's an eight piece. I mean, you're talking about horns, and there's a lot of parts. There's keys. There's a lot of parts of this band that really seem intricate. Like they have to be together to be this kind of band. Is it more than just the vocals?
Oh yeah. I mean, there are lots of great singers who are in bands that can't make them sound great. So I mean, like I keep mentioning the Stax band. I mean, that's this house band that played together, you know, in countless records, hundreds and hundreds of records over the course of, you know, less than a decade. And they made every singer that walked in that studio sound awesome. And they were awesome singers, but those same singers and other studios playing with different people never sounded that good. You know, I mean, we would probably not know Otis Redding's name right now if it weren't for
the band,
for what that band was able to do with them.
So, well, so anyway, drawing that back to like how our band came together, like at the beginning, we had drums, bass, guitar, and me, and actually we played together for I think like 3 or 4 months before we finally got a trombone player, Mr. Nick Natoli, who we actually just found him on Craigslist. We kept posting ads for trying to find a horn section and keyboard players, and we got a lonely trombone player. It was the first guy that we got to come in and play with us, and he had a friend that played saxophone at the time. So we just had sax and trombone, and slowly the other pieces came together, and the original sax player, he departed, and we had another one. So and then actually our original keyboard player, and who sadly Paul Pinkham, who's playing keys with us tonight, he's going to be moving away. This Saturday is actually going to be his last gig with us up in Madison at Chief the Lake. But our original keyboard player, Chuck Sansoni, who we actually also met randomly at a bar, he'll be coming back to join us. But yeah, it was kind of just funny. We were playing and playing at Reggie's, and our set at the time was like our second or third gig, and we were opening for live band karaoke. And after our band
that's
played,
how you know you've made it.
Yeah, after our band played, we tried to like take over the live band karaoke, and I asked if I could play a song, and they're like, we can't play because our keyboard player's not here. And this random guy came up to me, and he was like, I know how to play it on keys.
I'm sure he didn't sound that creepy.
No, I like that.
I was like, oh, hey, man, why don't you join our band? And he did.
Gina, you said you were playing in covers before. What was your attraction to soul music and this kind of music that you're playing here?
Well, I kind of like, I grew up listening to all kinds of stuff, but like, I always loved like bands with, you know, powerful, soulful singers. Like I loved Aretha Franklin, Otis Redding, and just like whatever I was listening to, I often listened to like, you know, classic rock and classic soul. And I would, you know, try and imitate Aretha or whoever. And, so it was, soul kind of speaks to my soul. I don't know, but
well, let's bring Eric in. Let's bring Eric Eisman in, who's a saxophone player. Yeah, here we go. Eric, you know, I'm interested in, you know, this is almost like it's a prereq for a soul band to have a horn section,
right?
For you specifically, I mean, were you attracted to soul music and playing this kind of music, or what was your upbringing in?
Yeah, I had started off playing in and around Chicago about a year and a half before I joined this band, and I was just playing with whoever would hire a 20-year-old sax player at the time, which was really just...
Doing that?
Anyone who is willing to sneak an underage person into a Chicago bar is pretty much...
But what kind of bands were looking for a saxophone player at that point?
There was a few cover bands, and actually I made a connection there with the original trumpet player in this band who got me a sub gig for the congregation. I remember he had given me the album the day before rehearsal. I learned the entire thing, wrote out the sax parts, came in, had it memorized, played it down with you guys, and then before I even played the show that I was supposed to be on, they said, hey, our old sax player's leaving, do you want the job? So that was kind of cool for me and gratifying. But yeah, I mean, it was just a matter of being in the right place at the right time for me to come along, and then I worked my way up from just being the young kid who was scared to say anything to being the one who goes through and does a fair amount of the arrangements and things like that. So
well, let's continue the conversation. Let's take a quick break because I want to get a song in before the news. We'll come back here with the congregation. They're playing on Saturday night at Shake the Lake Festival in Madison. They're also going to be at Untitled on July 8th. Their latest album is called Record Collection. They're live in Studio 435. The congregation, stay with us. It's The Download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman in Studio 435, our Monday night performance series featuring some of the best Chicago has to offer. Tonight, The Congregation, the rock, R&B, and soul outfit, their latest album called Record Collection. They're in studio tonight. Gina Bloom, Charlie Wayne, Paul Pinkham, Steve Schuster, Dan Wendt, Nick Natoli, Justin Amolsch, and Eric Eisenman. What are we going to hear here?
This is called They Will Fall.
They Will Fall. Yeah. All right, here's the Congregation live in studio.
Baby, not today.
Yeah, there we go. Woo! Give it up for the congregation live at Studio 435. Gina Bloom, Charlie Wayne, Paul Pinkham, Steve Schuster, Dan Wendt, Nick Natoli, Justin Emulsion, Eric Eisenman, live in studio. The latest album's called Record Collection. They're going to be at Shake the Lake Festival in Madison, Wisconsin this Saturday, and also at Untitled on July 8th. We'll have more, one more track, and we'll also have a little bit more conversation with the congregation. It's a download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. All right, Studio 435, the congregation here playing, performing live in our all-state showcase studio here and live on Michigan Avenue. The album is called Record Collection, and they're going to be playing Shake the Lake Festival in Madison, Wisconsin this Saturday. They're going to be in Untitled on July 8th. Gina Bloom, we've got the drummer now, Dan Wendt, is here, and Eric Eisenman on the microphones. All right, let's bring you in, Dan. You're one of the founders of the band. What drew you to soul music?
I was actually in college. I hosted a radio show, blues and jazz, and got into a little bit of R&B then and soul, and was always a big Otis Redding fan, and then kind of found out about Sam Cooke and other Stax stuff and was hooked. But Hooper and some of the people that we've played with over the years have really exposed me to a lot more stuff too. So, and then other bands that we play with that are also great.
Do you guys find yourself on sort of a soul R&B ticket when you guys play? Like if you're playing at a club, like you're playing at an Untitled and there's three or four bands, do they try to theme those nights?
So, one at Untitled, it's just us. It's that's a long set where we'll play like two sets, but sometimes we try to mix it up when we can and get bands that aren't necessarily just like us on bills because it's more fun. Actually, the most recent show we did, which was kind of an odd one, but really fun for us because we definitely got to play with bands we haven't played with before. But a couple Fridays ago, we did this show that was an adult prom. And it was with everybody else in the lineup was rock bands. So it was with Santa, Archie Powell and the Exports, The Kickback,
yeah,
and a group called Glam Camp, and we actually all played covers because it was a prom.
That's great. Yeah. Listeners that download will know both the Archie and the Kickback were both here on the show at one point. So
okay, nice. Yeah.
Cool. In that show we can all thank Eric Eisenman sitting to my right for having Careless Whisper by George Michael stuck in our heads for the past month and a half.
I had the good fortune of spending a lot of time writing out George Michael's Careless Whisper, Britney Spears' Toxic, and then an arrangement of No Diggity. Blackstreet did that song?
Yeah.
I spent way more time than I'm proud to admit arranging those in completely different styles. That'll mess with your brain after a while.
Let me ask you about the sort of soul scene here in Chicago. I mean, Chicago plays a huge role. First off, are you guys aware of the sort of soul music mecca that Chicago was, even beyond Motown with Curtis Mayfield and all the other bands that were coming up here in the 50s and 60s? Are you aware of that lineage being a soul band? And then secondly, where is the soul sort of scene? Where are bands like the Congregation sort of congregating in Chicago?
I'll take the first one. We're definitely aware of the history of Chicago and the, you know, the talent that's been through this city. And then I'll let you take the next question.
As far as the soul scene, I think there's not like a certain club that's like the mecca of where you play. We play the typical rock clubs that any kind of band plays here. We did our record release at the Hideout. We play out in Berwyn near where we rehearse at Fitzgerald's a lot and just all over the city. But as far as the scene, I actually think there's a great, new soul scene, I guess, in Chicago. Last weekend, I actually had the opportunity to work with a bunch of different soul musicians, and we were actually celebrating some of, like, the older soul scene in Chicago. Myself and J.C. Brooks of J.C. Brooks and Upside Town, the band Right Now, they actually put the show on, so they did a tribute to Otis Clay. The Right Now was the backing band, and they had myself, J.C. Brooks, Steph, their singer, Ava Fain, who sings with Bumpus. Yeah. They had a guy named Bashiri from, he's from St. Louis, I think, and a couple other singers. And we all took on songs from Otis Clay's catalog, and it was a lot of fun, like having a bunch of great singers in one room playing great music. And since I've been doing been in the congregation for a long time, I've had the opportunity to do stuff like that, singing with other, collaborating with other musicians, which is a lot of fun.
How do you collaborate within the band? I mean, when you guys are creating a record like Record Collection, what's the process like when you have such a big ensemble? When there's eight people and you're collaborating, does one person bring the songs and do you all work them out together? How does it work from the song process?
I think we're still kind of trying to figure that out to some extent. It's been 6 years.
Well, usually the process is so we're fortunate to have a few different songwriters in the band. Charlie being number one, I would say, in terms of musical composition, but also lyrics. And then Dan Wendt also is one of our songwriters who has done a lot of the songwriting, and our former and returning keyboard player Chuck Sansoni also has done a lot of the songwriting. But the process usually goes with whoever starts out the song will record some kind of demo, which I love getting. I love getting both Charlie and Dan's demos, but Charlie's especially because he'll record something on his acoustic guitar. It's always his acoustic guitar, and it's him singing and. They're when he's singing, it's kind of angsty, and you know, the songs sound like country or punk or something. And I'll listen to them. I'm like, I don't know what I'm supposed to do with this.
We may start a Kickstarter to produce and release a full record of
demos. Yeah. But Charlie Wayne demos.
Somehow, like once, like he'll send us these songs. I'm like, I don't even know what this is. And then somehow, once we start workshopping it with the whole band and like. You know, we get actual more instruments on it, and
Gina's voice,
yeah, right, changes
somehow.
Again.
Somehow they always come together, and like there have been songs that he sent us, and there's one song actually on our album Record Collection called "The Bottom," which we first sent out the demo. I think Dan and I both were like, we're not doing that song, like. What is that? And Charlie told us he cried writing it, and we were like, we don't care. But then
we cried listening to it.
But then we started working on it, and now it's one of my favorite songs on the album.
Yeah, I was going to say, it's absolutely one of the strongest songs we recorded for that process.
Well, the band is The Congregation. They're here at Studio 435. We'll take a quick break, and we'll hear another track. What are we going to hear when we come back?
We're going to hear Gonna Get You Back.
Gonna Get You Back. Live music here on Michigan Avenue, Studio 435, The Congregation. Stay with us. It's a download here on WGN Radio, Studio 435, our Monday night performance series featuring some of the best Chicago has to offer tonight. The Congregation, the rock, R&B, soul outfit. Their latest album called Record Collection. In studio, Gina Bloom, Charlie Wayne, Paul Pinkham, Steve Schuster, Dan Wendt, Nick Natoli, Justin Amulsch, and Eric Eisenman. What are we going to hear again? What's the name of the song?
This song is called Gonna Get You Back.
Gonna Get You Back. They're playing Shake the Lake Festival in Madison, Wisconsin this weekend and also at Untitled on July 8th. Ladies and gentlemen, The Congregation. Thank you.
gonna get you back. You traveled so far away from me. I tell you right now that ain't how it's gonna be. I know that my dream is gonna come true. I need you, baby.
Live at Studio 435 here on Michigan Avenue. Wow, there you go. The congregation are playing at Shake the Lake Festival in Madison, Wisconsin this Saturday. They're going to be at Untitled here in Chicago on July 8th. Their latest album's called Record Collection. Gina Bloom, Charlie Wayne, Paul Pinkham, Steve Schuster, Dan Wendt, Nick Natoli, Justin Amulsch, and Eric Eisenman. Thank you all for being a part of Studio 435 and performing live as a congregation tonight. We appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having us.
Take care. That's going to do it for the download tonight. Woo! What a jam-packed 4 hours of radio, live music, great conversation. Made a little news. Bruce Sagan talking about the Sun Times. Political arguments. A little bit of dead air. One break. Gave you everything tonight. Left it all on the table. Coming up, Patty Vasquez. Pretty late with Patty Vasquez. Tomorrow on the program, Chuck Klosterman's going to be here. Very excited to talk with him, the author of But What If We're Wrong, which is a great book. I read it all week. It's it's essentially a book about whether or not we're asking the questions that need to be asked of our society. And I don't mean like, you know, gun control and message and mission and stuff like that. It's more about the idea of, you know, why does gravity work the way it does? Really? Isaac Newton was right? Like, that's essentially it. And when you think about it, and he presents this great argument in the book where he's like, listen, most of the questions that were asked and that, you know, hypothesis or theories or answers were answered, we just take as human that's the answer. Well, there was another theory about gravity before the apple fell on Isaac Newton's head.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like from, you know, thousands of years before that, they thought of it differently. And it's only been a few hundred years with Isaac Newton, and we're like, yeah, that's gravity. We know that's it. It's like, is it? Or could it be something else? And so that's the book that Chuck Klosterman, who is a bestseller, great, who also has written for so many different publications. He's one of the founding editors of Grantland. He also was the ethicist for the New York Times for a while. So we'll talk with Chuck Klosterman tomorrow on the program. We've got a great week coming up here. I'm so excited. We have such great Governor Pat Quinn's going to join us.
How about
former
that?
Governor Pat Quinn on Wednesday. You continue to call a governor, even though he's not governor anymore. Governor. I'm going to call him Governor. Governor Quinn. So it sounds casual, like I'm being like kind of like folksy, but really I'm being British. kind of cool, right? Anyway, that's coming up on Wednesday night. Plus, I mean, so much more. And this week on Friday will be the triumphant return of the frying pan.
I miss him. I miss him when he's not around.
You know, we had the Taste of the Plains on Friday night. We didn't get a chance. That's too bad.
I'm sure he's gave him an extra week.
It's like a bye week.
Yeah.
It's a bye week.
Get healthy. Nurse those injuries.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. He just went through he did a couple of walkthroughs. You know, he didn't actually put the pads on.
He goes around his apartment with an orange jersey. Don't touch me while I'm thinking.
His family can't touch him. No, I'm thinking. I'm working. I'm innovating. It's on Friday night at 10 o'clock. All right, that's good. There's more this week, too. I keep forgetting. There's more coming up, so I'm...
Closed Sessions?
Yeah, the guys behind Closed Session, the indie hip-hop label in Humboldt Park. That'll be fun.
We'll be talking to John Williams.
That's right. Famed John Williams of Star Wars.
No.
Oh, different. Oh, the John Williams of WGN fame. That's the first, when John comes on, that's the first question. He'll be so annoyed. Like, I haven't heard that before. Badish would know.
No, he's never been asked.
He's never been asked if I started.
Never.
John's coming on. I think
it's
on
a
Wednesday.
Good move on your part. Seriously,
went, like,
yeah, go for
about,
it.
Like, in, I mean, what's the difference between Empire Strikes Back and the Ewok songs? See how he responds to that. Something tells me he's not going to enjoy that.
Ask him what the vibe is on that.
What's the vibe? Oh, yeah. What's the vibe? All right, well, that's going to do it for us tonight. Patty Vasquez coming up with Pretty Late with Patty Vasquez.